following America's wars in the Middle East. We're honored to have with us this afternoon Nir Rosen, a journalist and fellow at New York University's Center for Law and Security. I'm Chuck Frankel, and I'm a trustee of the World Affairs Council. A quick word about the council. The World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of an informed action. To learn more about how to get involved with the World Affairs Council and support our mission, please refer to the card on your chair or go to our website, www.itsyourworld.org. When you cannot attend a program, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts as well as streaming audio and video online. Council programs can also be heard on the weekly one-hour radio show called It's Your World, and that airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio, KQED, 88.5. And we are recording today's program. Our sound engineer is Robert Zimmerman. Thank you for being here. Now, before we begin, I hope you will all just take a moment and turn off your cell phones and anything else that's likely to make noise. And while you're doing that, I'll take the opportunity to tell you about two upcoming events, and they're both related to today's program. On Thursday, November 11th, the Council will host Kubad Talabani, representative of the Kurdistan regional government, to the United States, and he's going to discuss the current situation in the Kurdistan region, as well as Iraq, and the future role of the U.S. in that region. The event will take place here at the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Then Dana Allen and Stephen Simon will discuss the Iranian nuclear challenge, the likelihood of an Israeli preventive strike, and the ongoing Israel-Palestine conflict. The event will be on November 17th here in the Council Auditorium, 6 p.m. And lastly, I'd like to encourage all of you to use the blue cards that I hope you found on your chairs. Write clear and succinct questions, and I'm much more likely to use them. Hand the cards to the council staff, who will collect the cards during and after the talk by our speaker. Your questions will be posed to our speaker during the second half of the program. It's now my honor to introduce our distinguished guest this afternoon. Nir Rosen has been reporting from Iraq since April 2003 and has spent most of the last 7 years living there. He's also reported from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Yemen, Turkey, Egypt, and several African countries. He's a fellow at the NYU Center on Law and Security. His work has been published by the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, Rolling Stone Magazine, and many other publications. He's filmed for several documentaries as well. His new book, Aftermath, Following the Bloodshed of America's Wars in the Muslim World, describes his journey through the Middle East and offers his perspective on the local impacts of America's military engagements in that region. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll join me in welcoming Nir Rosen.
Thanks for coming. My book deals only about half of it with Iraq and the rest with Afghanistan, Lebanon, and other countries. Iraq these days is sort of a forgotten subject, much to my own chagrin. But I think you can't understand what the Americans are doing in Afghanistan, where we at least do have some attention, without understanding what they did in Iraq, what they think they did in Iraq, and what they think they're doing in Afghanistan, and whether that's accurate or not. The dominant sort of narrative about Iraq is that things weren't going that well because of a few mistakes the Americans made. And then in 2006, you had an explosion, blew up the Samarra Shrine, a Shia shrine, and the civil war started. And then this genius general called David Petraeus came up with a new way of fighting a war, came back to Iraq, and saved the day. And now he's going to do the same thing in Afghanistan. And that's just not really true. The civil war in Iraq started in 2003. In fact, you could say the Americans lost the war when they won the war. And in April 2003, they easily dispatched the Iraqi military, which for the most part chose not to fight. But for a variety of reasons, leaving aside whether the war was right or wrong, obviously it was wrong. If you're going to invade a country and occupy it, if you're going to be an imperialist country, a colonialist country, at least do it well, at least be competent about it. They used about a fifth of the troops that they should have used if they intended to stabilize the country, learning from lessons in Bosnia, East Timor, Kosovo, Haiti. So in April 2003, you had an absolute vacuum of power and of security. No government, no security forces, same time no electricity. There was just nothing. If you did that in New York, where I'm from, if you took away the police and local government, the electricity, you'd very soon have Puerto Rican gangs fighting Jewish gangs and just neighborhood militias forming up for self-defense reasons. Most likely, they would be based on some kind of affiliation because people trust people who are like them the most. And we've seen this in the U.S. in rare moments when the state disappears, like in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Likewise in Iraq, but almost immediately you had self-defense militias forming up. There were girls being kidnapped, there were and raped. There were scores being settled, and all night long, right after the war, we could hear the chatter of gunfire. And it wasn't the Americans fighting Iraqis yet. It was Iraqis fighting Iraqis. And nobody knew exactly who was being killed, but there was a real sense of fear on the street, and nobody was in charge. And that's when the U.S. lost Iraq. Those same militias that took over Iraq in April 2003 are in charge of Iraq more or less today. These days, they're wearing police uniforms or army uniforms or just the suits of politicians, but it's more or less the same movements and the same people. Now, the Iraqis tend to romanticize Sunni-Shia relations before the American invasion. Say, nobody knew who was Sunni, who was Shia. We were all brothers. We all drank from the same two rivers. We were from the same tribes. We married each other. That is not exactly true, but nor is it true the way some people in the West constructed Iraq, that these are ancient hatreds and Shias always hated Sunnis. And you needed somebody like Saddam to keep a tight grip on the country. Otherwise, you'd have this explosion of hatred. The Americans came in there with notions of a Sunni triangle, a Shia South, sort of imposing ethnic and sectarian categories on the country. Now, depending on whether you were rich or poor, urban or rural, religious or secular, in the government, from the north and the south, you had a variety of identities, and there might be different ways you felt about Sunnis or Shias. There were, if you were from this massive class of poor Shias, you'd probably feel very resentful for being outside the system. But Shias dominated much of the government. The Ba'ath Party, we perceived the Ba'ath Party as a Nazi party and as dominated by Sunnis. So we felt like we, the Americans, are rescuing the Shia Jews from the Sunni Nazis. But in reality, the Ba'ath Party was majority Shia. The army was majority Shia. Now, there was sort of a glass ceiling in some cases, especially in the 80s, as the regime began to feel more vulnerable, thanks to the Iran-Iraq War and the uprising in the South following the Gulf War in 91, which ended up expressing itself in some Shia terms as well. But Iraq had no history of Sunni-Shia violence. It took certain things for that to become, to translate into violence and militia warfare. Just as in Bosnia, it took media manipulation, in Rwanda as well, politicians, this whipping up of fear of extermination, that led to that kind of violence. And for the first 2 years, you didn't see neighbor killing neighbor sort of violence. But so you take these neighborhood militias that were formed, and you take the scores that were being settled, Shia Ba'athists were able to rehabilitate themselves to some extent. Sunni Ba'athists found that they were left out of the new system. The Americans came in there with this approach that you have to create a government based on quotas, so many Sunnis, so many Shias, so many Kurds. And from the beginning, Iraqis were very concerned about this. In the summer of 2003, there were demonstrations. The Americans were trying to create a civil war. Now, that wasn't true. But Iraqis had never thought of themselves primarily as Sunni or Shia. So the Americans began to institutionalize these sectarian differences. And by treating Sunnis as the bad guys, they also began to frighten Sunnis and push them into this position of being marginalized spoilers. And because the Americans thought Sunnis were the bad guys, loyal to the regime, etc., they had a much more hostile military posture in Sunni areas, like in Fallujah. Fallujah is kind of a classic example. It was an insignificant, sort of poor industrial town before the war. Iraqis might have stopped there on the way to get some kebab. It had a famous kebab place, but that was the only thing Fallujah was known for. Nowadays, it's known for being one of these real resistance strongholds. But for the first 2 weeks after the war, there were no Americans in Fallujah, and not a shot was fired at the Americans. There was no looting. In fact, locals took over administration of the government, of banks, and maintained order. April 28th, the Americans occupied a school. There was a demonstration. The Americans claimed they heard a shot fired. They opened fire on the demonstrators, killing, I think, 17 that day and a few more subsequently. And this began to turn people against the Americans in Fallujah and elsewhere. Fallujah is actually a key as well, because in the first battle of Fallujah in the spring of 2004, you had Sunni and Shia militias fighting the Americans alongside each other. Likewise, there was a simultaneous uprising of Shias further in the south, and you had Sunni militias supporting the Shias over there. At the time, I thought this was actually a great development because there was concern about Iraqi sectarianism and the future of the country, and I thought here you have this opportunity for Sunnis and Shias to actually work together and have this bloody nation-building myth that is often so necessary of unity against the foreign occupier, and they could overcome the trauma of the invasion and of sort of creating a new Iraq. But that didn't happen, in part because Shias got more and more tired of Sunni areas harboring people like Zarqawi. Shia truck drivers would be going down the main highway to Jordan, and Al-Qaeda-affiliated guys from Fallujah and elsewhere would stop them and slaughter them for being Shia. These constant attacks on Shias got them more and more frustrated and began to blame Sunnis more and more. And attacks on the police, which weren't necessarily anti-Shia attacks, began to feel like they were anti-Shia attacks because the police were majority Shia. So in the end of 2004, the Americans actually destroyed Fallujah. And you had hundreds of thousands of Sunni refugees from Fallujah pouring into western Baghdad. They began to displace Shias who lived in western Baghdad. Those Shias went to eastern Baghdad, began to displace Sunnis over there. And by the end of 2004, as Shias began to be more nervous about these Al-Qaeda-style attacks that were targeting Shias, local militias began to realize that if you can't figure out who are the Sunnis behind it in your neighborhood, the best thing to do is just to get rid of all the Sunnis, which they started to do in east Baghdad by the end of 2004. But Shias were very much on the defensive and felt weak until 2005, when you had elections and you had a Shia-dominated government, which was very much empowered. And they began to take the war to Sunnis, and not just to Sunni militias, but actually to the Sunni population. And the civil war was now quite intense in Baghdad and in a variety of rural areas around it as well. Well before the February 2006 Samarra Shrine incident, where you did see a huge increase in violence, but that was sort of Shia civilians finally just sick of attacks on them. And you saw a great deal of collaboration beginning in 2005 between Shia militias and the Iraqi security forces, the army and the police, which the WikiLeaks documents recently confirmed as well. This was happening at the same time as the Americans finally came to the right conclusion, but 3 years too late. General Abizaid, the American commanders in Iraq, realized that the American occupation itself was creating antibodies and was provoking hostility. And that was certainly true. The occupation was brutal and humiliating. But they realized this at a time when the main conflict in Iraq was no longer merely an anti-occupation sort of national liberation struggle, but it was now a civil war. So they decided by the summer of 2006 to pull back into bases and let the Iraqi security forces have more authority. But these Iraqi security forces were very much a party in the civil war, very much working hand in hand with Shia militias. And I saw this in an area called Huria in western Baghdad. It was a majority Shia area, but had a huge Sunni population as well. And that summer in 2006, the Mahdi army, the main Shia militia, worked hand in hand with the Iraqi army, the state, to cleanse thousands of Sunnis from this neighborhood. And the Americans stood by and watched them as they were leaving, sort of Bosnia-style, a massive flight. The Americans began to realize that if they do continue this pullout, there's also pressure from the Democratic Party at the Senate at the time, that you may actually have a regional war. The Saudis began to hint that if the Americans abandon the Sunnis of Iraq, then they're going to have to get involved. And there was a real shift. Sunni friends of mine who openly supported violent attacks against the Americans were watching Al Jazeera and other Arabic channels, and they were aware of debates back home, well, back here, whether the U.S. should withdraw or maintain the war. And they were terrified. They said if the Americans leave, we're going to be slaughtered. Likewise, I would meet Sunni resistance leaders in Iraq and Syria and Jordan, and their tone had really shifted. They used to feel very confident and cocky. We can easily get rid of the Americans and these Shias who are primitive and savage and inferior, and they've never ruled Iraq, and Iraq belongs to us. That was all gone by 2006, and now they felt victimized. They're sort of sitting with their hands in their heads, and you'd hear more and more, we lost. We miscalculated in 2003 when we boycotted the state and the security forces and handed it over to the Iranians. The Iranians, because in their mind, Shias equals Iranians. There's this tendentious view in much of the Sunni Arab world that Shias aren't real Arabs, that they're loyal to the Persians, and it's totally false. Iraqi Shias are Shia, but they're Iraqi nationalist, Arab nationalist. But there was that view that you began to hear Sunni resistance members talking about two occupations, an American occupation, which was at some point going to leave, and an Iranian occupation, which in their mind was far more pernicious, and to them that meant basically the Shia-dominated government. So you had this development, the Sunni realization that they'd lost, and an American realization that finally Iraq was going out of control, and President Bush, for the first time, actually began to really pay attention to events in Iraq and make that his main focus, because he realized that he began to think about his legacy. And there was a shift on the ground in American tactics beginning in the summer of 2006. In 2004 and 2005, you had Iraqi nationalist groups that were fighting the Americans who were tired of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, in their mind, was imposing these Taliban-like restrictions on them, no smoking, no playing dominoes. It was forcing tribal leaders to hand over their daughters in marriage. It was interfering with key smuggling routes in the Anbar province, which were a source of wealth for many tribal leaders. So there were attempts to rid the Anbar province of Al-Qaeda, but the Americans never backed these attempts. So the Iraqi Sunnis who were trying to do that got slaughtered. One of the big changes beginning in 2006, 6 months before Petraeus came to Iraq, was that American officers began to be sort of subtle enough and open-minded enough to cut deals with local power brokers, in their minds, bad guys who'd been shooting at them, but now there was a confluence of interest. Because Sunnis in Iraq began to also observe the increasing rhetoric in D.C., sort of anti-Iranian sort of rhetoric, and they realized we may have a common ally with the Americans, or common foe, I should say. The Iranians. Meanwhile, General Petraeus, who'd been in Iraq in 03, 04, 05, was at work with about 100 other people writing the counterinsurgency manual. He's often attributed with writing the counterinsurgency manual. It was more that he, you know, corrected a few typos and signed his name at the bottom of it and had many other advisors working on it. But the emphasis, the theory behind this is that rather than focusing on killing the enemy, you're going to focus on protecting the population, is the mantra, and sort of pulling the population away by various incentives and understanding their grievances, pulling them away from the guerrillas who are fighting them, using less violence and more subtle cultural and material incentives. Petraeus arrived in January of 2007. 6 months after a variety of changes were already being practiced on the ground, Petraeus was important sort of bureaucratically in that he ended up institutionalizing many of these changes and making them the rule rather than some creative officer in some remote town coming up with something on his own. Petraeus had the star power that he could do this without the approval of President Bush or anybody in D.C. Now, the Sunni realization that they'd lost, which you began to see that in 2006, led to this very important awakening movement, which started in the Anbar province, but then sort of mushroomed all over the place in Iraq, where Sunni militias who'd been fighting the Americans began to ally with the Americans to fight al-Qaeda. At the same time, the Sunni population in general was really growing sick of al-Qaeda. The main militias fighting the civil war, the Mahdi army protecting Shias, al-Qaeda protecting Sunnis, began to oppress their own population. Once the Mahdi army would get rid of all the Sunnis in the neighborhood, they began to impose sort of a reign of terror on their own population, acting like a mafia, extorting from people. Likewise, al-Qaeda might finish off all the Shias in the neighborhood, and then more and more they were acting like gangbangers. They were teenagers stealing cars, calling themselves al-Qaeda. It wasn't any kind of al-Qaeda you think of when you hear bin Laden's name. Al-Qaeda was just sort of a cool name to have, a good brand name from their point of view. The key to the American sort of success the defeat of the insurgency in Iraq wasn't a change in American tactics, and it wasn't an increase in American troops. It wasn't any American tactic. It was Black and Decker, the power drills. Shia militias, their hallmark, their signature, whenever they would execute a Sunni, were power drills. If you find the corpse of the power drill, you knew that he was killed by Shias. If you find the corpse with the head cut off, you knew Sunnis had done that. Everybody has their signature. We see this kind of thing in Mexico, too. It's not unique to Iraq. But it was the Shia terror which crushed the Sunni population and their will to fight, which was the key in convincing them that they lost and that they had to look to the Americans as protectors. And again, the WikiLeaks confirmed much of this. The Americans had a lot of knowledge about this collaboration between the Shia-dominated police and army and Shia militias. One example, and over the course of working on my book, I was actually surprised to see what extent the Americans were aware and benefiting from this Shia terror. There was a colonel, an Iraqi army colonel called Sabah in western Baghdad in 2006, and he was well known by the Americans and his own men for massive theft from people's homes, which was sort of common, but he would also arrest men randomly and demand sex from their wives in order to release the men. The Americans said that they're powerless to do anything about this because Iraqis have their own chain of command. But that's just one example, and there are numerous ones. Of course, Shias were being terrorized by Sunnis too, so there was an element of revenge in this. But it took this brutal Shia-led counterinsurgency to defeat the Sunnis and lead to the very crucial awakening movement. This is important when we try to think about what's happening in Afghanistan, as I'll get to later. You no longer had mixed areas in Baghdad and much of Iraq. Sunnis and Shias were now separated from each other. In most neighborhoods, all the Sunnis have been cleansed from Shia neighborhoods. Shias were cleansed from Sunni neighborhoods. So in a way, violence began to go down because there was nobody left to kill as well. There was a clear sense among Shias that they'd won and among Sunnis that they'd lost. Now, the Mahdi army, the main Shia militia, had its own ceasefire. You had a Sunni ceasefire that the Sunnis stopped firing at the Americans, and now were being paid by the Americans to go after al-Qaeda. At the same time, the Mahdi army, the main Shia militia, realized that the Americans are increasing, beginning in 2007, increasing their troops by 30,000. They're going to focus on Baghdad. We're in charge of Baghdad. Better to lie low, wait for the Americans to eventually leave or reduce their numbers, and resume controlling Baghdad. In addition, Muqtada Sadr, the leader of the Mahdi army, began to realize that the Mahdi army was giving him a bad name, and that many of its gangs were now thought of more as a mafia, as criminal, as abusive, and no longer really loyal to any kind of creed or ideology. So he created this unit called the Golden Brigade, which would drive around and assassinate rogue Mahdi army commanders. They were called icemen. It's the Iraqi Shia slang for sort of whacking somebody is to ice somebody. They would drive around with silenced pistols and take out sort of the bad Mahdi army commanders. So we had a Mahdi army ceasefire, a Shia militia ceasefire, and a Sunni militia ceasefire, an increase in American troops, and then you also had a change in American tactics. For the first time, the Americans were basing themselves within the population. What they did was, that, at least in Baghdad, you had these now ethnic or sectarianly pure neighborhoods. They would build vast concrete walls, very tall concrete walls around them. It was very oppressive. It was humiliating. destroyed the social fabric, but it was also very effective. And that now the Americans could control who went in and who went out. They could conduct a census, and determine who belonged in the neighborhood, who didn't, and prevent young men with arms from entering the neighborhood because there was now only one entrance. So you couldn't smuggle any weapons in, you couldn't smuggle any fighters in. And then they began to develop sources, so they were also more effective at killing the people they wanted to kill instead of just sort of randomly arresting and killing innocent Iraqis. And because they actually were living within, in the community and not sort of commuting to work, as they would say, they began to develop a better relationship with the people. And in many areas, the Americans, for the first time, were viewed as the least of all evils or even as protectors or rescuers in some cases. These walls also protected many of the Sunni population from the Iraqi police. There were many areas where the Iraqi police would drive by on the road outside the neighborhood and open fire on houses sort of randomly with their heavy caliber machine guns. And now they could no longer do that because these immense walls were protecting them. So that was actually sort of a relatively effective tactic, even if it has destroyed the old social fabric of Baghdad. The theory behind COIN, as counterinsurgency is called, at least the American population-centric counterinsurgency, is that you protect the population. That's the mantra. Really, it's when they talk about it, it's more about controlling the population, which they managed to do for the first time. But one thing which is less known about this period in Iraq, the Americans killed about three times as many Iraqi civilians during the surge as before, using airstrikes and using artillery in what they call terrain denial. So it didn't feel very population-centric to the Iraqi population, obviously. The civilian casualties were very high. But regardless of that, you had this confluence of Iraqi social and political dynamics at the same time as you had an increase in American troops, which allowed them to, for the first time, actually, control the population in Baghdad, which was the largest population center and sort of the key to the struggle. And you had a real shift in the in the Iraqi leadership. Prime Minister Maliki was very weak when he first came to power. Nobody ever heard of him. In fact, the CIA didn't have a biography of him. They hadn't heard of him, really, until he was appointed. They had to scramble and figure out who he was. He came to power with the support of the Sadrists, of the main Shia movement that had the Mahdi army as its militia. But as he began to realize that he can actually rule this place, and began to flex his muscles as a leader, he realized that he had to get rid of all the competition. The Mahdi army was the main competition for power, at least among Shias. And in the spring of 2008, in a surprise move, surprising to the Americans who had no notice about it, he went to war against Shia militias. It was called Charge of the Knights. And in Basra, in Baghdad, decimated them. Now, his forces would have been defeated were it not for the Americans scrambling to his rescue. The Americans couldn't afford to allow him to fail because it would make them look like they were failing. So American snipers and helicopters backed up the Iraqi army as they were crushing Shia slums where the Mahdi army dominated in Basra and Baghdad, other places. Many women and children were also killed by these helicopter and sniper attacks. But the Mahdi army was totally devastated. And for the first time, Sunnis actually began to view Maliki as an Iraqi nationalist. And the middle class in Iraq began to feel very grateful because there was a significant decline in violence thanks to the Mahdi army's total decimation. So then you have Iraq, the Iraq of today, a terribly brutal regime. Torture is routine and systematic. If you get arrested, you can assume that you're going to get tortured. They're going to sodomize you with bottles or broomsticks. They're going to beat you with electrical cables. They're going to wrap you with a wet blanket and electrocute you. But they're not going to do that because you're a Sunni or Shia. They're going to do that because that's how you get a confession. And you take the confession, you go to court, and the guy's convicted and goes to jail. It's sort of an institutionalized return to normal. So the Iraqi security forces, by 2008, began to be cleansed of the worst sectarian elements. Now they're extremely brutal. But if you're a random civilian, you no longer fear them, and they're pervasive. There are checkpoints everywhere. These days, it feels like Iraq is actually being occupied by Iraqis. And I say that deliberately, because you have a massive militarized presence of police and army everywhere you go. If you're driving through Baghdad, constant checkpoints. On the highways, constant checkpoints. Very intrusive and frustrating, but there isn't a security vacuum. There's not nowhere in Iraq where militias are in charge of a neighborhood or a village, or militias can take over an Iraqi police checkpoint as they once could have. And this is tremendously significant because now Iraqis no longer want their militias. When I first heard about the awakening phenomenon, I thought this was a horrible idea. Here you have a civil war where militias are fighting other militias, and you're going to create more militias. That's just insane. Not only that, these militias are sworn to overthrow the government. The Sunni militiamen would openly tell you, we have a hudna, a ceasefire with the Americans for now, because they're going to leave, and then we can overthrow the Shia-dominated government and rule the country. So it seemed like a terrible idea. But they miscalculated. They were very effective as a guerrilla movement when they were underground, unknown, sort of swimming with the population. But the population was, the Sunnis were depopulated. So now you had Sunni ghost towns in many parts of Baghdad. And the guerrilla fighters who had once been underground were now well-known public figures in every neighborhood. Their addresses were known. The Americans and Iraqis had their biometric data, their names, their phone numbers. Everything was well-known. They were registered and they were being paid, first by the Americans and then by the Iraqis. So they could never go underground again. At the same time, they failed to unite politically in any way or militarily. So they were very localized units. And as soon as the Americans began to remove their control over these guys, the Iraqis began to arrest them. Many of them deserved it. They were involved in all kinds of killings before. Al-Qaeda was killing them, sort of in revenge attacks. And they were just being fired from their work as awakening guys. So rather than being a threat, they were just totally devastated and emaciated. These days, most of the awakening guys I befriended in 07 and 08 are either dead or in jail or in exile. And the last remaining guys have been asking me to help them get visas to the U.S., which they're not getting because of our own anti-terrorism requirements for giving visas to people, the Department of Homeland Security. So they feel totally abandoned, but they can never go back to an armed struggle because the Sunni population doesn't want that. Sunnis no longer feel like they need a self-defense militia because Iraqi police and Iraqi army are there. Likewise, Shias don't want the Mahdi army back because they feel more secure than they did in 06 and 07 and 08. So the militia phase of the Iraq conflict is over. And the civil war is more or less over. And Iraqis these days will tell you the sectarianism is over. Just like people in Northern Ireland talk about the troubles, in Iraq these days they talk about the civil war as if it was a long-gone era. They talk about the sectarianism or the Sunni Shia. So my father was killed in the sectarianism, or my brother was killed in the Sunni Shia. And they all insist that it's over. And indeed, the armed phase of that struggle is definitely over. Maliki has a certain amount of legitimacy as a leader because he was involved in improving security. Obviously, he has the backing of a majority of Shias as well. And these days, Iraq is going to look more and more like Pakistan or Mexico, a strong regime, nobody capable of overthrowing it, terrible brutality, terrible corruption, terrible lack of services, and terrible violence on the street, which is just normal, and you just have to adjust to it with the help of Iraqi private security companies and just know when you can go out, when you cannot go out. And that's the new Iraq. And there's a great deal of potential for social unrest because Iraqis have very high expectations from the oil wealth, which they rightfully expect to improve their lives. But it's going to take at least 10 years for that to begin trickling down. And thanks to Iraqi corruption and inefficiency, maybe even longer. So we're going to see increased frustration on the ground, the government unable to provide any services to improve people's lives, and as a result, it's going to have to be more authoritarian in order to suppress this increased frustration and demonstrations, because it isn't going to be able to buy people off with services. Well, this is important to understand, because Iraq, if you think of Iraq as a success, you have more Iraqi civilians being killed in Iraq today than Afghan civilians. But at least violence is down from the terrible levels of 06 and 07. But none of the conditions in Afghanistan are similar to the ones that existed in Iraq. In Iraq, the resistance was Sunni-dominated. Sunnis were about 20% of the population. And they were totally defeated and crushed, and they were basically taught their place by a brutal Shia counterinsurgency tactic, along with American airstrikes and American assassinations. The Taliban is Pushtun dominated. It's not a Pushtun movement, but it is Pushtun dominated. Pushtuns are 38, 40% of the population in Afghanistan, the largest of all the groups. And the Taliban does not feel like it's losing. On the contrary, they have every reason to feel like they're winning. More and more parts of the country are in Taliban hands. If you leave Kabul these days, you're in Taliban territory within half an hour. So that key element doesn't exist. And we have no sign of any Taliban switching sides and aligning with the Americans or reconciling There's been many attempts, but nothing like that is actually happening yet. In fact, 3 days ago, we had the opposite. The Afghan police in Ghazni province defected and joined the Taliban. This happens quite a lot. The Americans have attempted to create militias, but in 15 or 16 cases, these local militias have actually switched sides and also joined the Taliban. Likewise, you don't have any government with any kind of legitimacy. A key element of American counterinsurgency is the notion that you have to build the government's capacity. But what if the government is a problem? If the government is predatory, and then instead of feeding the beast, you might want to starve the beast. But in Afghanistan, we're allying ourselves with a government which is hated, lacking any kind of credibility or legitimacy, and is perceived to be corrupt and oppressive. The Afghans' main interaction with the government these days is with the police, who might steal money from you. They might go into your grocery shop and steal goods and not pay for them. They'll demand taxes in arbitrary, sort of random roadblocks they set up when they're not doing drugs. So the Taliban, the Afghan police act as a recruiter, in a sense, for the Taliban. And even just in terms of being an American soldier, Iraq was easy. Most of the fight was in Baghdad. Baghdad is a dense urban area, has roads, a grid-like structure. In Afghanistan, the Russians controlled all the cities. But the Mujahideen in the 80s controlled the rural areas. Likewise, today, you can take Kabul and Kandahar and Lashkargah and other cities. The Taliban are in the rural areas, and they're fighting for the rural areas. And you can't build a wall around a village where every house is half a mile away from another house. We heard a lot a few months ago about Marja. It was described in CNN as a key strategic city controlled by the Taliban. I was in just outside of Marja with American troops a bit before that. It's not a city, it's not a town, it's an insignificant little village that nobody ever heard of before, which did have a Taliban concentration. It took, I think, 3 months for the Americans to take Marja. It was hailed in the media like it was a storming of Normandy or something. And once they got there, they realized that the Taliban are actually quite popular, and to this day, they're still fighting the Taliban in Marja. There's like 15 or 16,000 other Marjas in Afghanistan. So you can achieve victory here and there and take a town, but you can't actually unite that victory into anything meaningful and strategic because you're never going to have that density to control the rural areas. I'll speed up. And you're not going to be genocidal. I mean, if you were the Israelis or the Russians in Chechnya, you could devastate the Pashtun population and make them feel punished and make them lose. You could totally wipe them out. But the Americans don't use that approach. The Israelis have used that in South Lebanon or in Gaza. The British used it in Malaya. Malaya is often perceived as the one successful counterinsurgency. They took 500,000 ethnic Chinese in the 50s and moved them into concentration camps and defeated the insurgency like that. But the Americans aren't going to do that. So none of the factors that led to the sort of American success in Iraq, which still today looks absolutely terrible, exist in Afghanistan. And more importantly, to close, why the hell are we in Afghanistan anyway? If we're there to deter, dismantle, disrupt, defeat al-Qaeda, then we did that in 2001 and 2002. Al-Qaeda's not in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda's in Pakistan, in Yemen, in internet cafes and slums around the world. So we have this massive military footprint in Afghanistan where al-Qaeda isn't, as opposed to Pakistan where al-Qaeda is, or Yemen. Not that we should invade or occupy Pakistan or Yemen, but even by our own logic, it makes no sense to be fighting a domestic insurgent Islamist movement that has deep grassroots among many people in Afghanistan, and you're not fighting al-Qaeda at all. Now, they'll say we're in Afghanistan because we can't be in Pakistan. I think even more importantly, though, al-Qaeda doesn't really matter. At the time of September 11, al-Qaeda was about 200 people, according to American intelligence. We went to war with two countries and bombed several other countries because of 200 people who killed 3,000 Americans. It's an insane overreaction. We spent billions of dollars in war without end and created a much more popular al-Qaeda movement around the world, all because of this little pinprick that we felt in September 11, which was painful and tragic, but surely it wasn't worth this massive war. Now we have people sending bombs and airplanes from Yemen, and we don't even know why. Americans mostly don't. The Yemeni government is the worst government in the Middle East now that Saddam has been removed, the most brutal. And they use this phantom of al-Qaeda to suppress internal dissent. They've been bombing towns in the north with hundreds of thousands of people fleeing their homes, likewise in the south. So Obama's been perpetuating all the same pathologies of the Bush administration and creating more and more enemies where There previously weren't any. I guess time's up.
Time is up. But it's time for questions, and I know the audience is eager to cover many other areas. In your book, obviously, you don't stop with Iraq and Afghanistan. You do touch on Yemen. You go into Pakistan and Lebanon and Syria and Jordan, and I suppose we could keep going. But
do you want me here or there? By
either place. You are welcome
next to, you.
To join me. And I'll ask you the first question. At the very end, you touched on the Obama administration condemning it for some of the same faults of the Bush administration. The Obama administration started out, came into power with the American hope that that the administration would have a welcoming, a much more open, positive view toward Muslims throughout the world, and would avoid many of the mistakes of the Bush administration. Certainly Obama's speech to the Muslim world was a step in that direction. Could you appraise how the Obama administration has done in that regard?
I think the speech in Egypt may have seemed like a step in the eyes of many Americans, but in the eyes of many people in the Middle East, it was maintaining the same problems. Here he was legitimizing one of the worst dictatorships in the region, basically giving his blessing to Egypt's Mubarak by speaking in Egypt. And many of the things he said were also sort of alienating to people in the region. He was asking them to understand sort of Israeli suffering by talking about the Holocaust. Eliding the Israeli-Palestine problem with the Jewish Nazi problem. But there was certainly a great deal of hope, even in the Middle East, and I was there, that something would be different. If for no other reason, his name was Hussein, he was black, he was an outsider, surely he must be able to appreciate their suffering more. He wasn't Bush, and that was just the number one reason why he was popular, because anything has to be better than Bush. But on the ground, nothing has changed. In Iraq, certainly, we've reduced our troops. There's no longer... Iraq is weird. It's not an occupation, but it's not really a sovereign country yet. There's still about 40,000 troops left. But certainly in Iraq, our role has been reduced, and the occupation is much less of a factor than it once was. But everywhere else in the region, I think things have gotten worse. Obama has increased the use of drone strikes and use of violence in Somalia, Yemen, and Pakistan. And in every case, violence has only gotten worse. Certainly with Israel and Palestine, the most important conflict, the most symbolic one, and the largest motivating factor, I think, behind people's resentment of the U.S., Obama has proven cowardly and has done nothing at all has changed. I mean, he's allowed Netanyahu to reign free. Even when there was a settlement freeze, there wasn't really a settlement freeze. It was more on paper than in reality. I think people are very disappointed. And I myself see no change whatsoever. I think that there isn't that much Obama could do. Perhaps it's not the president. It's the nature of the American system. But I think there's more anger now and a greater sense of betrayal and disappointment. And we've totally abandoned even the notion of being pro-democracy, which Bush had in 2005 briefly. But now we're backing the worst dictatorships. As I said, we've tied ourselves to the Saleh regime in Yemen, which is absolutely brutal, and it resembles Saddam's brutality in many ways. We're backing the succession of Mubarak's son in Egypt. Obama didn't utter a peep during, he wasn't president yet, but during the Israeli war on Gaza, which was a war on a civilian population. So there's a lot of people who are very disillusioned, I think.
You're not suggesting that the conflict of Palestinians and Israel is responsible for the tremendous violence that you previously described in Iraq?
No, but it is responsible. It's the number one cause, in a variety of causes, for that might motivate somebody to want to attack the U.S. Or that provokes resentment and hatred of the U.S. Because here we are pretending to be honest brokers. When we approach people in the region, and from the beginning we say, we're not honest brokers. We have this romantic relationship with Israel, deep bonds, undying love, and we're going to maintain their military superiority over the rest of you. And we're going to block any attempt in the UN to censor them. So it's one of the factors which leads to a great mistrust and resentment of the U.S., especially when the weapons being used to bomb the civilians in Lebanon or Gaza or the West Bank are so often American weapons. And when the sanction to continue these wars, as happened in Gaza and Lebanon, is coming from the American Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense so often.
It was alleged that one of the reasons we went into Iraq was not democracy, but oil. And yet no one really today seems to see any oil flowing from Iraq to the United States. What is happening in that area? And could you also at the same time talk about how oil is affecting power and money in Iraq among the various sects, including the Kurds?
I don't think we went to war in Iraq for oil, but Iraq mattered because it was an oil in a crucial region that had a lot of oil, and certainly Iraq had oil. If it was the Congo, then we obviously wouldn't have paid as much attention, perhaps. Even in that sense, we haven't really been good imperialists because many of the good oil deals are going to non-American companies, Russia, China, Iran, the Saudis, even the Syrians, a variety of people are benefiting. But the Americans, not as much as they had hoped, I think. Obviously, in Iraq, oil is the prize, and that's why people are struggling to control the government, because whoever controls the government controls the U.S., certainly in the South. The Iraqi oil industry right now is hanging by a thread, though. It's from the 50s and 60s. It was destroyed by the sanctions. There's a real fear among the Americans that the whole thing could collapse and you could have a real environmental and economic catastrophe. So a lot of investment is going into refurbishing the infrastructure. And the Iraqis are going to have to pay that off before they actually begin to enjoy the profits of the oil. Although my knowledge about the industry is limited because I tend to focus more on violence than on the economy. But these days, it's more and more important, especially as violence has gone down, and you have political parties who are fighting over this crucial prize.
Hey, you haven't talked about the Kurds generally. I wonder if you could just talk about them a little bit.
Self-selecting thing, because the Kurdish region was always so much more peaceful. The Kurds truly are beneficiaries of the war. Life in Kurdistan is much better now than it was before. It is an authoritarian system up there. There's two authoritarian figures, Barzani and Talabani. Kuba Talabani, who's coming, is the son of one of those authoritarian figures. Dictators in the eyes of many Kurds. But there's been a massive investment, especially from Turkey. There's been a lot of talk from 2003, really, about the powder keg, about the possibility of Arab-Kurdish strife. And it appears that that's not going to happen. When Maliki first began to realize that he was a prime minister and this was his country, he began to test the limits of his authority, even in areas that the Kurds considered theirs. And you had a few clashes and skirmishes. But at this point, this is actually one area where the Americans have done a decent job. There's been a rapprochement between Maliki and Barzani. And I think both sides realize that they have nothing to gain from actual armed conflict. When you enter Kurdistan, you feel as if you entered a different country. You don't see the Iraqi flag. You don't hear Arabic. You have children who've spent, you have a generation now that has grown up without hearing Arabic, and to them the Iraqi flag is often a symbol of oppression. For quite a while, an Arab from Iraq trying to go up north to Kurdistan had to have some Kurd come down and pick him up and vouch for him. It was a very effective way of preventing any violence from occurring. But it is going to remain in this weird state where it's, in effect, its own country, but the Kurds are also crucial participants within Baghdad in the Iraqi political competition. And they're wedded to Baghdad, in part because they realize that given Iran and Turkey and Syria, the neighbors are not going to allow them to have their own state.
And are they going to get revenue from the oil in their area?
Oh, certainly. From Kirkuk as well, but they've also been cutting their own deals with companies to explore in other regions. I'm saying in other areas within the Kurdish region, I should say.
So what you described in Iraq today is a country which is stabilized to a great extent, although there's still a great deal of violence.
It's a stable instability in that you have, 2 days ago, a great example of that, terrible, terrible terrorist attacks and violence all the time. And when I was there, I got back a month ago, every day in Baghdad, there were assassinations with sticky bombs. These are small magnetic bombs. You could be sitting in traffic. Someone walks by and puts it on your car, and you're blown up, and nobody knows why. Or you have guys driving around in yellow taxis with silenced pistols. And it's constant. But it's not the kind of violence which has a strategic impact. It's terrible and it's scary. But if you're a normal civilian, unless you're really in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're probably not going to get hurt by it. So there's no, at least no longer any movement which is trying to overthrow the system or contesting the system. So in that sense, the system is stable, but the violence is still very brutal.
Several people want to know how you've survived.
I have the right face for the job. If there was a war in Sweden, I'd have more trouble. There could have been a much more talented journalist than me. But he just couldn't get in a taxi and drive around the country because he would have been spotted. So that has been an advantage in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. But also, I got there in April 2003, and I had some knowledge of Arabic, but I worked very hard to be very good at it and to learn as much as I could of jokes, of culture, of movies, of songs. Worked out in local gyms and developed friendships with guys my age. Who've been helping me out ever since. And if you're friendly to people, they're usually friendly back to you.
You've had some unfavorable experiences, though, haven't you, in Taliban-controlled areas?
Well, some of them were friendly to me. In the book, I describe going down to Ghazni province with a Taliban commander. The idea was to spend 10 days with the Taliban group and see how they live, how they adjudicate disputes between people, how they attack the Americans, what life is like in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. And the group I was with, the local farmers mostly, some were teenagers, some were in their 50s, but all were local, which reminded me of Fallujah, were local guys fighting the Americans as well. But they were feuding with a rival Taliban group in a nearby village, which was more extreme. And the guys I was with, unbeknownst to me, had killed 11 Arabs and Pakistanis who had been with this other group of Taliban fighters because those guys had wanted to close down a girls' school, which my guys were in favor of. So I sort of got caught in the middle of all that, and the other group had a bit more authority. They were higher up on the chain of command. And they didn't know that my trip down there had been approved by Mullah Boradar, who was a Taliban minister of defense at the time. So they called up the Taliban Minister of Information, a guy called Zaibullah Mujahid, which is actually, there's a bunch of guys who answer the phone at different times, and they all call themselves Zaibullah Mujahid. But nobody ever heard of me, so they assumed, oh, I must be a spy, and sentenced me to death. But at the last minute, the Minister of Defense called up and said to let me go. So everything worked out okay.
Well, we're glad you're here. So you say that in Iraq today there is relative stability, unstable stability, and there's democracy to some extent?
To some extent, Iraq is the only democracy in the Middle East, but it's often just a veneer of democracy. I mean, democracy is more than just having elections and having institutions. Many of the laws are violated. Certainly, human rights aren't respected in any way. And Prime Minister Maliki is exhibiting more and more Saddam-like qualities. I don't think he'll ever be that brutal. He doesn't have to be here, presents the majority of the population. But opponents are crushed or marginalized. You have Iraqi Special Operations Units, which are extremely well trained by the Americans, who can kill anybody they want at will and are totally above the law. So democracy exists formally, but it's in practice, you don't really see any signs of it. The government provides almost no services. People are growing more and more cynical because they feel like they voted for nothing. Corruption is rampant. So if you get arrested, you know you're going to get tortured, but you're also going to expect to pay thousands of dollars, not for your release, but just to go through the system so that your lawyer can get a hold of your of the charges against you so he can take it to the court. Every step of the way is $500, $1,000. And you also have police and army officers sometimes arresting somebody just for the money. I have a friend of mine who during Ramadan, officially smoking in public or drinking in public is eating or drinking or smoking is prohibited, although everybody does it, including the police and the army. Iraqis aren't a very religious people. But a friend of mine was driving in a relatively expensive car and smoking during the day in Ramadan, and police who were also smoking arrested him and charged him $2,000 for his release. The pretext was that he was smoking, but really they just wanted $2,000. So it's there are elements of democracy, but there's also real brutality and authoritarianism and corruption.
Are the Iraqis better off now or under Hussein?
Well, the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who are dead are not better off. The millions who were displaced from their homes are not better off. The tens of thousands who were languished in American detention are not better off, nor are their families who lost fathers. The Kurds are better off in general, absolutely. But I just don't think you can do that kind of math, because some are better off, some are worse off. The region in general is less stable. Democracy has been given a bad name. Liberals in the region who may have wanted to tie themselves to the U.S. and now want to get as far away from this as they can. And the cost has been so high that even if Iraq were to emerge as a model democracy, I don't know if you could ever say that people are better off when you have such a deep, deep wound in the country.
How do you see the role of Iran in both Iraq and Afghanistan? And do you find them cooperating or following their own agenda? Are they meddling? And finally, what's the reaction of the Iraqi people to the role of Iran?
In Iraq, everybody is meddling. Certainly we are. But the Iranians, the Saudis and Turks have a huge influence in Iraq. In Iran, of course, did as well. It was a more significant influence when the occupation was more significant. The Iranians had an existential threat next door. And you had this massive military presence from a country that had vowed that it was supporting regime change in Iran, in the U.S. So obviously they wanted to do everything they could to undermine the American presence in Iraq, make it look like a failure, and also mire the Americans in Iraq down as long as possible so that Iran wouldn't be next. Because when I was working on my book, I came across articles from May of 2003 talking about how Iraq was such a success. Not should we go to war with Iran, but it was more about when and how. So Iran certainly felt threatened and did everything it could to undermine the Americans there. But fundamentally, Iranian and American interests are the same in Iraq and Afghanistan. Iran is deeply opposed to the Taliban. And Iran is backing Maliki in Iraq now. We both want sort of a strong central Shia government, which is friendly. So I don't think we have any fundamental conflict with Iran when it comes to that. Iran is deeply involved economically, of course. But one thing we actually learned from the elections was that Iran isn't as influential among Shias as the Saudis and the Turks are among Sunnis. And that they basically created Alawi's list, the Iraqiya list. And they've been pressuring his people now not to compromise and strike a deal with Maliki. And I would be surprised if some of the attacks that we see, like the ones 2 days ago, are in part sponsored in some way by groups associated with the Saudis. It's a negotiating tactic, perhaps. It's sending a message to Maliki: if you don't compromise and give us a better share of the deal, then we can hurt you. And it's true that to a certain extent, Sunnis can cause some pain to the government. The Kurds, who are only in the north, for 80 years were able to destabilize Iraq, but Sunnis are in Baghdad and they're throughout the country. So they're going to be able to conduct these kinds of attacks to put pressure on Maliki to give them what they feel is a more fair share. And I think that's what you're seeing. But the Saudis have a history of supporting this kind of stuff in Lebanon and elsewhere, so it wouldn't be surprising if they were involved in it. But Iraqis are xenophobic and resentful of all their neighboring countries, not just Iran, including Shias. I mean, if you talk to people in the Iraqi army and Iraqi police, they perceive Iran as a threat. Shias obviously at some point were driven into looking to Iran as an ally and friend because they face hatred from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, from Jordan, from the Sunnis in the region. But even Muqtada Sadr, who's now in Iran, his movement is a deeply Iraqi nationalist movement, feels very strongly about Arab causes like Palestine. And Iraqis resent any foreign involvement in their country, not just Iran's.
Give you a chance to be a fortune teller. This is the last question. Look ahead, if you would, 10 years from now. You've got all these moving parts, all these countries in turmoil. What's likely to be the situation in 10 years?
If Maliki isn't assassinated, I expect he'll still be in power in 10 years. I think Iraq will look very much the way it does now in 10 years. Some of the wealth may start to trickle down to people. You do have a burgeoning nouveau riche as well. That's not going to change. At some point, there'll be another Israeli war with Lebanon. I don't expect any large-scale violence unless there's an American or Israeli strike on Iran, which could easily develop into something much more regional. The Saudis just went through the largest arms deal in the history of the world, and the Israelis didn't utter a peep in protest because this is an arms deal aimed at Iran. I think you'll see Prime Minister Mubarak's son, President Mubarak's son in charge of Egypt, increasing frustration with that. I think Israel, in the long term, is not viable in its current makeup as a sort of an apartheid state. With it, there's not going to be a two-state solution. They've made sure that's impossible by taking over more and more of the West Bank. And Israelis also don't feel the need to compromise. If you're in Israel these days, you're in a thriving, positive, sort of hopeful environment. You're not feeling the pain of the Palestinians in Gaza or the West Bank. Well, I was in the West Bank a little over a year ago. People feel defeated. The Israelis were able to impose a system of control, which is so awesome. The Americans never came close to it in Iraq. Every town is surrounded. If you lift your head up in protest, you're going to be crushed. They learned that in Gaza. So the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza aren't able to resist in any real way. And if they try to resist in terms of civil disobedience, unarmed demonstrations, they also get arrested. People often ask, why is there no Palestinian Gandhi? It's because he's in jail. But the Palestinian citizens of Israel are growing increasingly angry and also feel increasingly threatened by the growth of the Israeli right and more signs of Israeli fascism. You're going to see clashes, I think, within Israel. And the most powerful movement among the Palestinians of Israel are the Islamists. Unfortunately, there's no left in the Middle East today left. I think you'll see growing clashes. The next conflagration in the region may start from within. There's a million Palestinian citizens of Israel who are feeling increasingly oppressed. And the main threat to Israel in its current makeup as a Jewish state is democracy, is this Palestinian call for democracy and equal rights. And we see the population in Israel more and more drifting to the right. When there is a clash, Hezbollah is going to be involved, Hamas is going to be involved. At some point, it's going to affect other countries in the region. Something terrible is going to happen from there. But barring an American attack on Iran, I don't think any massive violence will occur. Things will be pretty much the way they are now, which is not an optimistic thing to say.
Well, but we appreciate very much your insights. You've had a tremendous amount of experience. We're out of time. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, thanks very much to Nir Rosen for providing us with his thoughts and insights based on real experience. Thanks to the audience for your terrific questions. And I'd like to remind all of you that Mr. Rosen's book is available for sale, courtesy of Books, Inc., and he'll be available to sign copies here on stage. Thank you very much.